You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how to know if it's time to get that second COVID booster. Now some weather talk. Is it just me or has it been windier lately? On the one hand, I feel like, yeah, it is. I've had to move the garbage and recycling bins out of the wind more often. I feel like I'm getting hit with the wind more driving on highways. On the other hand, I'm just one subjective human observer with absolutely no data to back this up. So we called a meteorologist for a look at the wind, plus other weather stuff like some record-breaking heat last week. Tim Halbach is a warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service Milwaukee. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, wind, Tim, according to Rob's garbage bin indicator measure, there have been more windy days this last year than in the past. Is that happening or is this just me?
It's you and all of Wisconsin. That their garbage cans have reported to all of us. It's been a very active pattern from basically April through early May, where it seems like we've just had weather system after weather system that's come through. And even though some of them haven't been that strong, there have been some really strong low pressure systems that have caused some extended periods of severe weather to ourselves. If you look, anywhere from, down by the Gulf, they've been dealing with tornado outbreaks and severe weather. And it's because of these large low pressure systems that have been coming through. And it seems like it's been very active this year. So we have looked at some of the data, and on average, it is trending a little bit higher than what we've had in the past during this time of year. Not record-breaking by any means, sure. And we haven't had too many in the way of wind advisory type situations, but definitely on the whole, it's been a very active low-pressure system type windy scenario we've been in.
Over time, do we see more concerns about a heavy wind, straight line winds? Like, I don't think I knew the word derecho like 5 years ago, and now we've had a couple of those over the last couple of years in Wisconsin. Those heavy straight line winds that can be really damaging. They're not tornadoes, but they can really do a lot of damage. Are we just learning that word now in the non meteorological community?
Yeah, it's basically kind of in the same vein as the polar vortex, where it's something that meteorologists have used to describe different weather patterns and scenarios. The derecho is a technical term for a squall line that lasts for a very long time. So it has to meet certain criteria where there's storm reports over a certain mileage. I think it's somewhere over 200 some miles that a storm like that has to go. So we typically get about one or two of those a year. There's things that we typically get most of our severe weather from here in Wisconsin. It might not be at that high end type level, but we've had some big ones. May 1998 is kind of the standard for Wisconsin outside of also the Northwoods blowdown a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But in terms of straight line downburst type winds, it's the most common type of severe weather that we get here in Wisconsin.
And before we move on from my obsession with wind today, Tim, what makes the wind blow? It sounds kind of poetic, but what is it? You mentioned pressure. Is it all about pressure differentials?
Yeah, pressure. We look at where high pressure systems and low pressure systems set up. And if you're right underneath the middle of a big high pressure system, we call that a big bubble, no trouble type days. There's not a big gradient to the pressure that we have there. So if we had a lot more of those days, you'd be maybe talking about how there hasn't been a whole lot of wind, but we've either been in between the area of where the high and low pressure systems are, which creates that really tight pressure gradient, which is what leads to a lot of these windy type days. So if you're right in the middle of one of those, then it tends to have less wind. If you're stuck in between, like we have been for the past few months, it tends to be a windier type scenario.
Talking to Tim Halbach from the National Weather Service, Milwaukee. Well, Tim, last week, I think if you asked people about the weather in much of Wisconsin, they weren't going to talk about wind. They're going to talk about the heat. Pretty hot for May. What did we see?
Yeah, we basically started looking at, this long cold pattern that we were in. And we were like, we're going to get like one day of spring here. And then I think we're going to go straight into the summer period. And that's... you talk about where the low and high pressure systems go, the high pressure system got into the southeastern United States, which is a favorable one for us to get that moisture surge and hot air from the south coming up into Wisconsin, and it just kind of got stalled there. So pretty unheard of to have that streak of high temperatures getting into the 90s. I don't think Madison had ever seen 3 or 4 days in a row where you hit 90. So very unique weather pattern that we got in there.
Yeah, were we seeing records broken? I knew coming into it, there was a thought that we would be flirting with high temperature records for those days.
Yeah, we broke quite a few high and low high temperature records, along with, I believe, the streak for Madison was to have 2 days in a row of 90 degree temperatures. We've never had 3 or 4 days in a row, which I believe we had last week. Closer to Lake Michigan, with the differential between the lake temperature and land, we had quite a strong lake breeze that kicked in. So Milwaukee broke some records too, but it was super early in the morning before the lake breeze could come through and knock it down. So it was technically a record-breaking scenario that we had there.
And now we're headed into Wisconsin's severe weather season. We start to worry about damaging thunderstorms and, of course, tornadoes. What are you watching for this year?
Yeah, I mean, every year is a little bit different for when we get these. Last year, we had some storms come through in the middle of the night, which caused some other issues, you know, just with being prepared for those storms. You know, any year, it kind of we get severe weather here every year. It's a matter of how frequent it is and, you know, how bad it actually is. So it's important to be prepared. It's, if you haven't already, you know, set yourself up for multiple ways to get warnings. This is the time to do it before we actually have more rounds of severe weather. So it's a matter of time till we'll get some. It's just a matter of when and where. So time to get prepared now and be ready for it.
And Tim, before I let you go, I think I saw you're involved in a study of so-called these urban heat islands, including places like Milwaukee. What are you looking at?
Yeah, so we're going to have people driving around Milwaukee with a thermometer and dew point sensor, which will be measuring the heat at 3 times during the day on a really hot day to kind of map how the urban heat island works. So if there's pockets of Milwaukee that are hotter than other areas, we'll be able to study that and come up with ways to kind of help those areas out for whether or not they need different trees or more trees or just more access to cooling centers and other things like that. So it's kind of a unique thing that's going to happen here this July.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist for the National Weather Service Milwaukee, with us today to talk about some record heat last week and certain people's perceptions of high wind here in Wisconsin. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about Lilies of the Valley and family connection.
Lilies of the Valley are often considered a beautiful yet high-maintenance plant. For writer Nancy Jorgensen, they will forever connect her to her beloved grandmother, who found virtue in caring for them. Caregiving was deeply rooted in her grandmother. She dreamed of being a nurse, but society had different plans for a woman of her era. Jorgensen reflects on her grandmother's devotion to her family, dreams, and flowers.
It was May 1977 when my grandmother, Nana, led me to her basement, past the black iron cook stove, then the shelves of home-canned beans and beets. I sniffed the stale scent of Wisconsin wood fires and the mustiness of potatoes in storage, odors familiar to me since childhood. "Come see the lilies," Nana said as she leaned the screen door open and planted one leather shoe into her shady backyard. I was 22 and just married, but Nana's gardens still felt like home. "Bring that shovel," she said. "We'll dig some for your new house." Nana cultivated other species too, phlox, daffodils, violets, pansies. She coaxed each into a vibrant melody until her country yard trilled with color. Every year a new song, but her refrain, always Lilies of the Valley. 4 decades later, Nana's darlings transform my spring landscape from a dirt and grass hoedown to a frothy white minuet. Nana has been gone many years, but her lilies still sing and sway. Nurseries call them a high-maintenance plant, but Nana considered their spreading a virtue. Their duty in life, like hers, to place roots, scatter beauty, and pass gifts on to a new generation. Lilies of the Valley thrive in shade, As a woman of the 1920s, so did Nana. Her list of chores, change diapers, weed gardens, wash floors, cast long shadows over each day. Wife and mother was not her first choice of vocation. Many years earlier, she dreamed of an education and a life devoted to healing. "I always wanted to be a nurse," she said. Instead, she lived like neighboring farm wives in her husband's shadow, reflecting warmth and light toward him. Like Nana, lilies of the valley rise early and bloom in the dawn of summer. Slender columns strut low to the ground, each boasting up to a dozen tiny flowers, pure white, only millimeters across. Of all Nana's flowers, I wonder why these captivated her the most. Was it their delicate bell shape, with round shoulders, fat waist, and frilly lip? Or their heady scent, spicy and persistent? Or was it because they required no harvest, existing only to be lovely? Lilies of the valley symbolize rebirth, purity, youth, and happiness. But Nana delivered them to the grave of her son, a sailor in the U.S. Navy, and later her husband, who died at only 59, and then another son, whose heart suddenly gave out. In life's valleys, her lilies intoned a requiem. My 30-something daughters inherited Nana's love of gardening. Gwen, a professional athlete, sows kale, plants parsley, and nurtures her bed of mint. Elizabeth buys seedlings from her high school students who grow them in biology. For my daughters, planting is play. The stakes are low. If their gardens produce, they make a caprese salad or add chives to lettuce from the farmer's market. They have none of Nana's worries about climate's uncontrollables like rain, sun, drought, cold, or heat that could result in hungry children. Two generations on either side of me, relishing the wonder of a seed, the beauty in a bloom, the gratification of growing. In 1921, a necessity. In 2021, an amusement. Nana's gardens became her vocation. She buried regrets and tended her plants as she would have tended patients. My daughters garden at their leisure, free to pursue their callings, teacher and writer, professional athlete, or nurse if they so choose.
Writer Nancy Jorgensen brought us that story about her fondness for lilies of the valley. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, an epidemiologist tells us why only 11% of Americans 50 and over have gotten their second COVID booster so far, and how to know if it's time to get yours. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. The FDA approved a second COVID booster shot for immunocompromised people and people 50 and older back in March. But only 11% of people age 50 and older have gotten that second booster so far. How do we know if we're eligible? How do we make the decision of if and when to get a second booster? Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Let's start with that recommendation from the FDA. Why are they saying, hey, people 50 and over, people who are immunocompromised, if you've already gotten that first booster, go get that second one?
Yeah, so this second booster is really designed and meant to prevent people from getting severe illness, not preventing from preventing infection. And people who are 50 and older, are about a third of them, are likely to have significant comorbidities, putting them at risk for severe illness if they were to get COVID. So the recommendation is for anybody over 50, especially somebody over 60 or 65, who is at risk for severe illness. A second booster will really help them.
And why have we seen relatively few people who are eligible based on that age get that second booster shot?
You know, accurate or not, many people probably see themselves as being relatively healthy and then weigh their decisions accordingly. And I would say that it's important to talk to your doctor to see if you are at risk for severe illness. There are lots of conditions that might put you at greater risk. So having diabetes, obesity, cancer, chronic kidney disease, even mental health disorders and some disabilities, cardiovascular disease. Those are all things that can put you at risk for severe COVID if you were to get infected. And of course, if you're immunocompromised, you should definitely get another booster. And that lower age is actually 12. People who are 12 and older should be getting another shot.
If they're immunocompromised.
Yeah, moderately or severely immunocompromised.
I've seen some people talking about, you know, well, the timing. Maybe somebody wants that second booster shot, but, you know, can they kind of time it so that it's, you know, maybe we'll see another outbreak in the fall. So maybe get in August or something like that. Is there anything to trying to play the timing game with this?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are doing that. And, you know, it's one of those things where as soon as you get infected and you mistimed whether to get a booster, you know, you might regret it. But again, remember that these second shots, second boosters are meant to prevent severe disease, not infection. So if you get the second booster, you could very well get infected. The vaccines aren't going to prevent that, particularly with the new BA2 subvariant that's circulating. It can still infect you, but you can avoid severe disease. And I think, you know, perhaps when cases get even higher than they already are, people may benefit more. Or if you're about to go to a gathering or visit, you know, family members who are more vulnerable, I'm sure people are doing that timing. But it's better to get it, or at least talk to your doctor about getting it if you think you are indicated.
Now, of course, at the opposite end of the spectrum, Ajay, there is still a significant chunk of the U.S. population who has had zero of the COVID vaccine so far. For someone who hasn't gotten the vaccine, especially someone who hasn't had COVID at all, they've got no protection there. How big a difference is getting that first round of shots going to make for them?
It's really important, simply because when you look at the characteristics of people who are hospitalized with COVID, having severe illness, they're largely people who are unvaccinated, or they may have even had COVID before, but not have been vaccinated. If you had COVID previously with one of the earlier variants, that kind of immunity is just not going to last this long to protect you against what's circulating now. So someone who's unvaccinated, someone who's immunocompromised and therefore under-vaccinated also at high risk for hospitalization or worse.
With timing of boosters now, back to boosters, what are the time recommendations for getting that first booster? How long do you have to wait after your first round? And then between the first and second booster?
Yeah, so the antibodies begin to wane 4 to 6 months after the first booster. So the CDC recommends after 4 months of completing the primary series, you know, get and the second booster, first booster, get the second one. For the first booster, that will depend on which vaccine you got to begin with. And for example, if you got the Johnson & Johnson shot, single dose, getting a booster sooner is better. And then eventually you really do want to get the RNA vaccines and not another J&J shot. So it's important to not make it too soon and to wait at least a few months to be able to get that booster.
Now looking toward the future, Ajay, is there talk, are there efforts to update the vaccines to keep up with the current profile of variants of the virus that causes COVID-19?
Yeah, there are efforts to develop an updated vaccine specifically for Omicron. That there's talk about it being available this fall, but you know, and this is probably factoring into the decision people are making regarding getting that second booster. They might see themselves as generally healthy, and they can wait for that Omicron-specific vaccine. I'd say that until the data are available and the manufacturers are ready to produce that, let's not assume it's going to be ready by the fall, but that's the aim. I say that because, you know, we've been talking about getting vaccines out to children under 5 and it keeps getting delayed. So it's best just to decide if right now you're indicated for a booster to get it, if it's going to benefit you, preventing you from getting severe disease.
Talking to Ajay Sethi from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID vaccine boosters, when you can get that second booster if you've gotten the first one. Ajay, turning to wider trends, now we had a lot of downward trends in case numbers, deaths down to a lower level than they have been in quite a long time. Starting to see, it seems like, some warning signs that numbers are starting to pick up around the country. What are you watching there?
Yeah, transmission is picking up. There are more counties in Wisconsin that are at that sort of medium community level that the CDC gives us as far as a metric of the situation going on here. Wearing a mask indoors is now going to become more important as community transmission continues to increase. Around the country, the northeast of the U.S. has been increasing in cases and now hospitalizations for a little while, and we're following that. We should expect a continued increase in cases in Wisconsin. Hospitalizations also have been increasing, and hopefully it won't get too high.
You mentioned masks. Now, mask mandates are off the table in Wisconsin, but I'm guessing people ask you from time to time, Ajay, you know, when and where should I wear a mask now? What do you say to people?
Well, if they're asking me that question while indoors, I'll already be wearing one, so I'll demonstrate the importance of that. I'm wearing a mask indoors whenever I can, and you know, definitely in public places, occasionally taking it off if I have to, especially when I'm eating. But it's really important that people are aware that there's a lot of transmission going on now. The newer variant, subvariant of BA2 is more infectious. And if we calibrated our behaviors to sort of earlier variants, thinking, you know, we weren't wearing masks and we got away with not being infected, those calculations are different today. The virus is more infectious. It's always been airborne. It lingers in the air, and it's just important to wear a mask indoors when you can.
Ajay, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is an associate professor and director of the Masters of Public Health program at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at COVID booster shots. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, libraries around the state are using federal relief money to provide unique services in their communities. We'll find out what's going on, and we'll invite you to give a shout out to your own local library. Plus, a look at possible changes to voting in Wisconsin, maybe in the works. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then there are multi-megawatt solar and wind energy projects blowing their way across Wisconsin, part of a major push to transition away from coal power. We'll talk to an engineer about some of the challenges and what Wisconsin's clean energy future could look like. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll check on U.S.-Israel relations after the killing of a Palestinian-American journalist in the West Bank. First, we talked on Central Time last month about Governor Evers' new clean energy outline for the state. Now, we're going to dig into some of the projects that are in the works as part of the transition to more renewable sources of electricity here in Wisconsin. Earlier this month, California marked a period where just shy of 100% of the state's total energy demand was supplied by renewables. Is Wisconsin on track to follow in their footsteps? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about Wisconsin's efforts so far to expand wind, solar, and other renewable energy production? What about coal power? The goal seems to be to bring it down to zero over time. Do you think that's a good idea? Is there a solar or wind farm in the works for your area? Are you happy to see it or worried about it? Would you be willing to pay a little bit more on your utility bills in the transition period to help meet some of the expenses of the change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lena Rold is an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. Her research looks at ways to optimize energy grid systems, integrate renewable resources, and manage the impact of grid failures. Lena, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with this story in California a couple weeks ago. You pointed this out to us. They had just shy of 100% of their electricity needs supplied by renewable sources. Is that a big deal?
Yeah, I think it's a really big deal. It's really amazing to see that it is possible to have 100% of the grid in California being fed by renewable energy. It's a really large grid, lots of energy, and it's all coming from renewables. It's I think it's above and beyond what many people thought was possible only a few years ago or 10 years ago or so.
Now, people here in Wisconsin might say, yeah, that's California. They have big areas with, I think, pretty reliable sunshine, for example. Lots of, mountain ranges and, varied terrain to capture that wind. Is something like that realistic here in Wisconsin?
So I think we can, you know, I mean, we have to kind of hope for it, right? There's a shift that is ongoing. We see that the utilities in Wisconsin are quite aggressively closing down their coal power plants and coal generation, and that has to be replaced by something. And some of the really good things about wind and solar is that they generate jobs in the state. They are, you know, energy that is being, that comes from Wisconsin, rather than, for example, having to import coal or natural gas from other parts of the country. So, you know, that, and then, of course, we really have the opportunity to reduce pollution that currently comes from the coal power plants and also carbon emissions, both from coal and natural gas, very substantially. And so, you know, I'm at least hopeful that we are moving in the direction of more renewable energy here in Wisconsin.
I want to mention a couple of specific projects in the works. Iowa County has the Badger Hollow Solar Farm in the works, 300 megawatts. The Koshkonong Solar Energy Center in Dane County approved for construction, 465 megawatts. Those sound like big numbers. How much are those in terms of our energy usage here in the state, though?
Yeah, so I think it is helpful to think about that in two ways. So when we think about energy, we have to, and electricity in particular, we have to think about both the electricity we are using right now. So this is the numbers that you were mentioning, 300 megawatts, 400 megawatts. This is the power that is generated instantaneously. And so, for example, if you take as a comparison, the Columbia Energy Center has a peak capacity of around 1,100 megawatts of power. So in that sense, you know, those projects are really, you know, around 70% maybe of the Columbia Energy Center power. So that is huge, right? The Columbia Energy Center is a big coal power plant. And these solar power plants are actually kind of coming close to matching the capacity that we will need in terms of just power generation capacity. The difference, though, is that solar and wind, as we know, that energy is actually coming from solar and wind. And so we need sunshine and we need wind in order to be able to generate electricity. And so that is different from conventional power plants like the coal power plants, because for the coal power plants, all we need is coal. And so once we have that coal available, we can choose when we want to generate electricity. And so one thing that is really, really important as we are moving towards having more wind and solar is that we are able to ensure that we not only have capacity to generate sort of the total amount of power at peak generation, but also that we are able to match the demand for energy over time. And so that is a challenge needs continued work to look into and make sure that we are able to meet that energy demand day to day.
That reminds me of another project then, the Paris Solar Battery Park in Kenosha County. It's approved, again, supposed to generate 200 megawatts, but also provide battery storage for, they say, 110 megawatts of electricity. How is this idea plausible that, okay, we'll have these big battery parks that are going to store solar and wind when we get it, and that's going to smooth out, as you say, those times when we don't have the sun shining?
Yeah, so certainly like batteries can be a really important part of the solution to try and smooth out the variability in wind and solar generation. Also batteries, they can operate by themselves. They can also be charged by other resources. So it's great to have batteries. That definitely gives extra flexibility. However, there is also, you know, a limit to what we are able to do with batteries, because batteries are also expensive to build. They require chemicals to be built. There's cost associated with them to also operate them. Battery storage is important, but there's also, I think we have to see that if you look, for example, to California again, what we have seen there is that California does have quite a bit of energy storage, but even so, you know, it actually charges up. So you can imagine if you have a 200 megawatt solar farm and you decide and you have 110 megawatt battery storage, that is actually just kind of an hour of the solar farm. And so there's a limitation to how much you can charge and how long you can hold onto that power before you have to start discharging again. And so battery storage is great for daily variations in solar. For example, you can charge it in the day, you can discharge it at night. But then if you get to, for example, seasonal variations, where maybe in, say, in spring, in California, for example, there is a lot of extra energy that comes from wind and solar that can't be used by the grid because they already have enough. They already are at 100%. And so they actually have to say no to some of the wind and solar power in order to make the grid remain stable. And what would be really great if it would be if it would be possible to take that energy and store it until the summer months when we need more when we need more energy because of air condition in California. It would of course also be great if we could take that energy from California and send it to Wisconsin. But that is the question of actually sending electricity across long distances. That is quite challenging because you need to have transmission infrastructure in place. And that is again something that is expensive to build.
We're talking to Lena Rold, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison, looking at the transition to renewable energy sources of electricity, especially wind and solar. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Lena, we've got those projects I mentioned, the larger ones. There are also some smaller, like 90 megawatt projects in the works. How easy is it to take a new wind or solar project and plug it into that transmission grid you just mentioned so people can actually use the stuff?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think when we look at this, we have to remember that we need sort of everything. We need to have generation capacity in terms of just generating power at the time when we need it. It needs to match in time with the demand for electricity. And then we also need to be able to actually bring the power from the power plant to our homes and businesses and industrial plants, right? And that is the role of the grid and all the power lines that are out there. I mean, as a professor of electrical engineering, I always enjoy when I drive around to look at power lines. I know that there are many people who don't like to look at power lines, and I respect that. But we need them. We have to have a way of taking electricity and bringing it to our homes. And so it is very important as we are building out this renewable energy that the grid companies also are following along and making sure that we have sufficient transmission capacity to be able to take that power from the places where there is wind and solar available and bring it to the places where people need to use the electricity.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hi.
Yeah, I've got a simple question for you. Using older technology, how many megawatt hours do you have potentially for using pump storage to store excess production of solar and wind power rather than using batteries?
Oh, interesting, Jack. I'm only vaguely familiar with this, Lena, the idea that you use that excess electricity now to pump a little reservoir full, and then when you need the energy, you, I guess, get a kind of hydroelectric thing out of that?
Yeah, that's correct. That's it's an exception and a question that essentially, yeah. So let's talk about what is pumped hydro first. So what pumped hydro is that you have a hydropower plant. So a hydropower plant where you are generating electricity by letting water down from a higher altitude to a lower altitude. And so, for example, where I come from, which is Norway, there is a lot of mountains. And in those mountains, there are hydropower reservoirs or lakes where there is water stored. And then when you want to generate power, you can let that water down from the mountain and let it power a turbine that generates electricity. So it's really potential energy that when you have the water high up in the mountain, you have the possibility to let it down and then generate electricity. And so it's possible to build pump hydro power plants outside of the mountains. You can, for example, I mean, it's a question of, you know, how much altitude difference do you have? And so that here in Wisconsin, where things are a little flatter, it can be a bit of a challenge, right? You need to have a height differential in order to use pumped hydro. But there are some storage plants or there are people who think about how can you actually build these pumped hydro facilities in ways that they can work like a battery. And it is true that currently, as of right now, hydropower and pumped hydro is really one of the few long-term energy storage possibilities that we have. So when you look at the hydropower reservoir, when you have large ones, like more of the natural kind, you might have the ability to store energy in those reservoirs over several months. When you build a new one, kind of more in a location where it's maybe not, a mountain in and of itself, I've heard people talk about, a gigawatt hour of storage, which is a really big storage. It would be a very, very big battery. But it's in terms of like what the grid might be needing in the future. It would be really great to have this, but it might not entirely solve the problem, but hopefully part of the solution.
Jack, thanks for that call. We're talking about clean energy projects in the pipeline for Wisconsin. Lena Rold is with us, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the practical side of converting to renewable energy? Do you have projects in your area? Are you happy to see them? Are you worried to see them there? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Lena Rold, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. She specializes in energy grids and renewable energy conversion. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we look at projects around the state transitioning away from coal to renewable energy systems. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Ken is with us in Cambridge. Ken, hello.
Hello. The thing I live in Cambridge, and the farm that's going in, concerned about it because that's covering up a whole bunch of agriculture land that we should be using for growing food. The other thing is the companies that produce these farms and the people that okay them don't live in the area, and they don't have to stare at the damn things every day.
Ken, thanks for the call. And Lena, both of those are concerns that we've heard from some of the communities getting these projects. B, people don't want to look at them. And A, it's, using land we could be using to grow crops.
Yeah, and those are really important concerns, and they should be heard. And so thanks, Ken, for bringing that to the conversation here. So there is definitely a question of should we use, for example, agricultural land for photovoltaics? Is that a good idea? There are people who are looking into questions such as agrovoltaics. So can you actually use multiple use of the land so that you don't have to only have solar panels on it? And then, of course, the sort of buy-in of the community and the willingness to actually keep having solar panels or wind turbines that are often more visible. I mean, those are very important questions. I don't have any detailed and specific, I don't know if I have a solution to share about those. Other than that, I would say that I absolutely hear those concerns, and I think that is super important to think about and hear everyone's concerns and try and make sure that the benefits that come from generating renewable energy also goes back to the community where that renewable energy is being generated.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. We heard from Bill on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who also has a couple of projects in his community, including one on, he says, land that his family used to own. He writes, "It causes some emotion to realize such productive farmland will be going out of production for 30 to 40 years. On the other hand," Bill writes, "it must be acknowledged that continuing to burn fossil fuels carries severe consequences. So overall," Bill says, "I welcome the introduction of solar projects." There's a lot of weighing of costs and benefits here, Lena.
Yes, and I think that is exactly the question, right? I mean, what is the right thing to do? There should be a lot of weighing the costs and benefits because these are really, really big questions. How do we actually continue to live our lives in a good way and then also make sure that we don't destroy the planet. So we need renewable energy. We need this in order to be able to continue to have access to energy. And then we also need food, and we also need, we need to have communities we want to live in. And so I can absolutely imagine the emotions that come when you see that there is this change that is happening to land that you are familiar with, and that there is change that is happening there. I don't know if I have. I'm a technical expert,
sure.
But I really, you know, what I think that we as a technical community also are, you know, starting to think quite a lot about how, you know, what are the technical solutions that we can maybe help contribute to also improve energy efficiency and so on, in order to maybe make sure that we don't have to have as much transmission infrastructure, so many power lines, that we don't need so many solar panels, that we can get away with having the smallest amount of them possible. So, you know, while also being pro renewable energy, I definitely see that there's a very important aspect of trying to limit the impacts on the environment of actually setting up wind turbines and solar panels as well.
We also heard from David on Facebook, who brings up the issue of nuclear being a cleaner, safer option. David says than even the other renewables we're talking about. But Alina, this is a huge topic to ask you about with just a couple few minutes left. But do you see nuclear playing a role for some of our baseline electricity generation?
Yeah, so, and you say it exactly there, right? The baseline electrical generation. So electrical generation is such that we do need sort of the baseline, the kind of power. There's always a certain demand for electric power. And it is helpful to have some power plants that are there and always reliably can provide that power kind of throughout the day, throughout the year. And so, you know, I am of the opinion that nuclear can be an important part of the solution. And there is also work that is ongoing in terms of making smaller nuclear power plants that maybe could be safer. But there is this question of with nuclear about the waste that comes from nuclear power plants and how to handle that. And of course, also the danger of what can go happen if something goes wrong. It's a CO2-free source of energy. And so in that sense, I don't think that is a source of energy that we should be writing off. I will say that solar is actually getting to a point where it is maybe more cost-effective than nuclear power. And so there is a lot of questions here about, you know, what is actually, you know, how do we actually, what is the benefit of sort of having the insurance of base power versus having the cheapest possible available power? And some of this also comes down to how we as individuals and as a society might be able to change the way we use electricity, both maybe use less of it, but also maybe use it in a way where we can use electricity when there is solar and wind available, rather than when we sort of just need it right now. And if we took an approach to electricity, which is a little bit more focused on flexibility in time and space for where and when do we use electricity, that might also then help us, make better use of wind and solar, and then maybe we would need less nuclear. I think there's a lot of open questions there. But nuclear, in my opinion, is not something one should look away from at this moment in time.
In just our last half a minute or so, what are you watching most closely right now in the transition to renewables?
So I think what I was just touching on, this question of like, how can we arrange our energy system such that we are able to use energy when it is available? That I think is really important. We mentioned, started out here talking about how California reached 100% renewable energy. That is amazing. At the same time, California also has had many periods of time where they are not making use of all the solar and wind energy that is available. And I think that is a natural part of the process. We can't get to 100% and expect to just get to 100% with wind and solar. We might sometimes overshoot a bit, but finding ways of overshooting less, or essentially making use of that opportunity that comes with that overshooting, like having extra excess energy available, I think that is an opportunity and also a challenge that I hope we can all kind of help contribute to in the future.
Lena, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lena Rold is an assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at UW-Madison. She joined us for a look at the transition to renewable electricity in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, a Palestinian-American journalist was killed last week in the West Bank. We'll talk to a Middle Eastern relations expert about the global response and U.S. interests in the area. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.